Welcome to Finding Contentment, the official podcast of the American Institute of Stress. The goal of this podcast is to explore the science, psychology, and practical wisdom that can help us manage our stress. If you are looking for personal growth and professional success, or just want a more fulfilling life, visit us at stress.org. And now here is the host and executive director of the American Institute of Stress, Will Heckman.
Hey, greetings, everybody. Welcome back to Finding Contentment, the official podcast of the American Institute of Stress. I'm your host and executive director, Will Heckman. Hey, I want to remind everybody to visit us at stress.org. I know a lot of you are asking yourself that you're feeling a lot of stress. You don't know what to do. You don't even know where to start to manage it. One of the greatest places to start is if you come to us, we have two assessments that really point out what your stress triggers are. It's the SMQ and the Roth Stress Profiler. You'll see them on our site. And at stress.org. So go there. And while you're there, subscribe to the magazine. So there's a lot of great articles about a lot of different things, both combat stress and contentment. And speaking of subscribe, hey, do me a favor, hit that subscribe button. It really helps out the channel and it helps us to bring shows like this one today to you guys. So go ahead and just hit the like and hit the subscribe button. Today we have a topic that comes up very often at the American Institute of Stress, and that is sleep problems. Sleep problems are really bad because they like build on each other. You know, stress and insomnia share a very complex and often symbiotic relationship, interwining to create a challenging cycle that affects both mental and physical well-being. Stress, whether it's stemming from work pressures or personal concerns or other sources, they can trigger a heightened state of alertness and anxiety, and making it difficult for individuals to unwind and just fall asleep. And conversely, insomnia, which is basically characterized by an inability to obtain sufficient sleep, that can amplify stress. And by diminishing the body's capacity to cope with whatever your daily demands are, and that leads to increased irritability, impaired cognitive functions, and a general sense of yuckiness, unease. And the reciprocal interaction underscores the importance of addressing both stress and insomnia. And we need to do it comprehensively. We need to employ strategies that encompass not only relaxation techniques and healthy sleep hygiene practices, but also, when necessary, talking to a professional, and maybe they can intervene to help us break free from this intricate cycle and restore a balance of restfulness. There are also some newer methods and to fight the challenges of insomnia. So I asked an expert if she can give us some insight on what we can do about insomnia. Maybe we can find an answer. That's why we're here. So joining us today is Laura Barrett Nutting. She's better known as Nurse Laura. And she's a certified cannabis and integrative medicine nurse health mentor who brings over 20 years of experience helping patients cope with critical illness and chronic disease. And her enthusiasm for wellness has led her to explore multiple medical cannabinoid options available. Nurse Laura has worked in each of the plant-touching cannabis fields, growing, processing, opening dispensaries, as well as sales and marketing and compliance. So Nurse Laura works with providers, patients, caregivers, and dispensary staff to educate and inform and collaborate to find the best options to improve quality of life. And she founded the National Clinical Directors Consortium to support the role of clinical directors across the country. And this group works to ensure access to healthcare professionals, nurses, pharmacists, cannabis providers, so that they're knowledgeable in plant medicine for patients, dispensary staff, and other providers. And Nurse Laura also serves on the board of the Connor Sheffield Foundation, promoting research and advocacy for medical cannabis. Listen, to find out more, because I can't tell you all, just go to her website, and that's asknurselaura.com. Ask Nurse nurselaura.com. So please join me in welcoming Nurse Laura. Hi, Laura. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. It's always so humbling, like, to hear someone read your bio.
You know what? I had to cut it down a little bit. I always have to cut down the bios. You know, you've been doing this for 20 years. It's a couple of decades. Your bio is
very old. Yes. Yes. It's true. And really in the plant medicine, cannabis medicine field, for like the past 10 years.
Right.
But so it's even more years now.
Right. And it's changed.
Of nursing. Yeah. And really part of what helps me to be an integrative medicine nurse and like help people for their whole health. It's really like a holistic, that the coolest thing about nurses is we generally are holistic. We're looking at the whole picture and not just applying one modality and not just thinking about one specialized piece of you. And so I've worked in so many areas of nursing way before I even considered working in this plant medicine space. Mm-hmm. I can't ever start any podcast or presentation without saying, I'm not a doctor. This isn't medical advice. I will try very hard not to say anything that doesn't have research to support it. And I'm happy to share with your viewers if they want, after the fact, if they reach out to me, some of the research or the findings that I might be basing anything I say off of. I really try to share. If I don't know an answer, I will try to say that, and I'm willing to go research it and look it up. Or I'll share with you if it's my opinion.
Okay.
My goal is to give solid information in a credentialed way and not, just whatever, I personally think. So I really try to do that. And the most important thing is, before you start anything new, even an exercise program, you should talk to your doctor. Yep. Please communicate with your doctors. It's important.
And if they do want to get in contact with you, go to asknurselaura.com and you can ask her a question. So we're talking about insomnia today and sleep problems. We say insomnia, but that covers a lot of things. You know, like last night, I couldn't fall asleep until like 2:30 in the morning. Why? I haven't a clue. I really don't. Everything was fine. But
let's get into that though. Like, I'm curious. Yeah. So do you drink caffeine?
I do, but only in the mornings.
So you have a cutoff and you didn't go past your cutoff yesterday.
Never.
You didn't have hot chocolate in the afternoon. Nope. Or some chocolatey dessert. Nothing.
No, I'm not a big dessert guy anyway. No, and I'm really conscious of that too. And I also don't drink alcohol after like dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't drink much. I'm a lightweight. I mentioned before the show, I'm a biker. And a lot of you will be surprised to hear this. Bikers don't drink much. I know in the movies, we're a bunch of drug addicts and drunks, but it's a bad idea to do that and get on a motorcycle and go 80 miles an hour. So a lot of us are lightweights, we're teetotalers. I'm close to that. So, because I know some people will have a glass of wine in the evening before they go to sleep. That can cause a problem too, can it?
Yes. So I think it's such an interesting conversation to have. And I love when people schedule time with me. We used to do in-person visits, but now mostly it's over Zoom, over a phone call. And we start talking about just, what is their day? Like, I'm asking you, like, what did you do yesterday? How does your lifestyle impact your sleep or inability to sleep, whether that's fall asleep, stay asleep, get up in the morning, feel rested after sleep? And so many people claim that the alcohol is helping them sleep. And the research shows that even though alcohol is a depressant, so it's like labeled a depressant, it actually impairs your sleep and over time causes you to have worse sleep and less quality sleep and not be able to get into that deep sleep, REM sleep, which is really what helps us to feel rested. So I know there is some data about some types of alcohol. The research usually talks about red wine and flavanols and the wine being good for your heart. And I am all about balance. Again, as a holistic nurse, as an integrative medicine nurse, if anyone hears me ever, what comes out of my mouth most often is balance. I don't personally believe, and as a practice, believe that anyone, unless you have a severe allergy to something or a medical reason, should be all in or all out of anything. So a little bit of alcohol, again, if you have a history of adult of alcohol use disorder, maybe you need to be all out. But if you don't, a glass of wine or two, a couple times a week, maybe not every day, you know, and early enough in the evening. Because the other thing that alcohol also does, and again, you might have talked about this in the past, but this also impacts sleep, is it relaxes those flaps in your body, right? So you might have heard of GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disease, or just heartburn, or alcohol relaxes these flaps in your body so that when you go to lay down, especially if you've had alcohol in a big meal, the stuff can, you know, move around and come back up. If you have feelings like you referenced, icky, icky feelings and symptoms, and those things really do impact your sleep.
For me, I found, you know, if I have a glass of wine, which is rare, and I drink cheapy, crappy wine, which is very sugary, I'm sorry, it wears off. I wake up. You know, I have a glass of wine, it helps me fall asleep. Mm-hmm. An hour or two later, the alcohol wears up, and I wake up, and now I'm up. So for me, that it doesn't work. Some people it does. That just gets them relaxed enough to, I guess, get their mind to calm.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And so that's, again, another one of the things when I work with people that we really have to talk about. So it's funny. So as a plant medicine nurse, cannabis nurse, people schedule time with me with the intention of saying, which gummy should I take for sleep? Like, that's probably the number one question, is which gummy should I take for pain and which gummy should I take for sleep? And I always take them back like 10 steps. I'm like, hold on.
Yeah.
First of all, it might not be a gummy. Second of all, it might not be plant medicine, cannabis. Let's talk about what your struggles are. What are you dealing with? And I'm very careful, again, as a registered nurse, I'm not diagnosing, I'm not prescribing. And cannabis is federally illegal. It's a Schedule I drug, and it's not legal in every state. So depending on where you're listening, this may not even be an option, but right, most states have some type of cannabis program. But I'm always like, what is the issue? Do you have problems falling asleep? Do you have problems staying asleep? Do you have problems feeling rested when you wake up? Is it all of the above? Do you feel hungover in the morning? What medications do you take? And sometimes for many people, it's as simple as they're taking so many medications for other things, or even the sleeping medication or anxiety medication at bedtime, and they're taking it so late at night that they can't wake up in the morning because of the prescription. And I'm like, before we do anything, how about we just try, or ask your doctor if you can try, just move that medication. Instead of taking it at 9 p.m., take it at 7 p.m. And maybe you won't feel tired and hungover in the morning. You know, like,
there's— yeah, that makes sense.
And so with alcohol and with eating dinner, like, that's a really big one. I think so many people, our society, depending on whether you're in like the young family stages or in like middle age, like young, not middle age, 30s, 40, like working really, or you're in retirement, when you eat your nighttime meal, mm-hmm. and how big that meal is might change. You know, in European cultures, right? Like, are you Italian? I think I'm right. Guessing.
No.
I'm Italian. No, you're not Italian.
No. In fact, I certainly think I'm not.
So, you know, in Italy and in Europe, right, the big meal is supper, is like midday, right. And it's a lighter meal in the evening. But here in the United States, we tend to eat big meals and we just eat later. Like, somehow it's like cool to go out and eat dinner late. I don't understand that.
I heard something once that made a lot of sense to me, because nutrition is— I was when I was an athlete, nutrition is always part of the deal and stuff like that. And people that I actually really respected said, eat breakfast like a king, eat lunch like a prince, and eat dinner like a pauper. Mm-hmm. And I followed that for a long time, you know, and also reverse, eat dinner for breakfast, eat lunch, and then eat breakfast for dinner, things like that. And that definitely affected sleep. One of the things I did want to ask you, because you talk to a lot of people, mm-hmm. and a lot of them are experiencing, you know, sleep problems. And what do they say to you is the common triggers? Do you find the most common triggers that are keeping them, if they're, I mean, it's for an ongoing problem. I don't mean I couldn't sleep last night, big deal, tough it up, you know, but I mean, I know people that are literally suffering from insomnia. Yeah. We'll talk a little bit about that, but what do they tell you?
So there are two things, and you know, your show is about one of them, right? Stress is absolutely, stress causes sleep issues. There's no question. The other big one is pain, and anyone that has pain has stress,
right?
Whether it's physical stress or emotional stress. You can't have pain and not have stress, anxiety, depression. It goes so hand in hand. A big group of people that I work with also are veterans. Mm-hmm. And so post-traumatic stress disorder and a fear of sleep because of the images and the memories that will come up, and just safety, it is a concern. But the number one thing that crosses all of those, so if you have this post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, then you have stress. If you have pain, then you have stress. So really, stress is like the biggest, broadest.
Right. I have to tell you, that's pretty much what we have found also at the American Institute of Stress, that when people complain about their sleep patterns, the circadian rhythms and all that, if you delve a little deeper, you're exactly right. It's something to do with something stress related, whether it's work or financial or family or whatever. It is something that they're not managing, that part of their existence. We all have stress. We need stress. It makes us better people. It's not managing it. And yeah. Not sleeping will cause more stress. It's a horrible merry-go-round.
Yeah. Well, and as part of your intro, you mentioned like so many things that can be impacted by not sleeping. Yeah. One thing that you didn't mention that is another factor that causes more stress in many of the adults I work with lives, is weight. So weight gain, not sleeping.
That's a good point.
Causes your body to have more issues with insulin and ability to process sugars, and therefore leads to weight gain and an inability to lose weight. So here, sometimes some of the people that I work with, and again, you can read this, and it's all over like social media so many times for the people that are promoting health and wellness, that sometimes people will forgo sleep to do a workout because they're so focused on, I have to work out, I have to exercise, and they might be better off. Not everyone, it really depends on the person, but routinely they might be better off focusing more on getting quality sleep than on doing a longer workout and forgoing sleep to work out.
Well, I can tell you that in the last 6 months, I've gone back to the gym and started pushing around weights. And so I don't do anything in my life without research, much to the chagrin of my family. So I research everything. And the one thing I learned is exactly what you said. If you do not sleep, you will not gain. Your muscles, your body needs that recuperative sleep in order to heal. And when you work out, what you're doing is you're tearing your muscles up so they grow. Right. So, you know, if you don't sleep, you're not going to grow. You're going to get more frustrated. It's going to be stressful. And guess what happens? You're not going to sleep. So,
and also it's the hormones, though. So the time during your sleep is when your body can rebalance and reset your body back to homeostasis. And we release cortisol and our hormone levels change once we get into that, that deep sleep. Like we really need, ideally, we would get this deep sleep, like an hour plus, an hour, hour and a half each night. And I know just based on, because so many people are using tracking devices, like, I don't know about you, but like that, you know, this Apple Watch, it tells you at least to some extent. I don't know that I believe it's right all the time. Sometimes I'm like, that is not true. I know I slept less than that or more than that, but it shows you based on your heart rate, right? When you might be in that deep sleep or REM sleep, all these different phases of sleep. And it's during some of those cycles where different hormones are released that are going to impact how you feel when you wake up. And then what first when you wake up, you know, those next things and what you put in your mouth. And, you know, you mentioned your philosophy of like, you know, eat like a king for breakfast. Many people, again, related to weight loss and health and how they feel, are doing this intermittent fasting.
Yes.
Isn't for everyone, but for some people, based on their bodies and their regulation, not eating first thing, even though there's so much science that talks about feed your brain in the morning,
right.
There definitely are now some data that are showing that for some bodies, it's better to not eat first thing. You know, so it's so interesting. It's so individualized.
Yes.
All medicine is so specific.
And you're right. You know, just because I said I've heard that doesn't mean I do it. And I'm one of those guys who need to work out empty. I can't eat before I work out. I've talked to a couple of other people like that too. But one of the things I did want to ask you about is the role that lifestyle plays in our problems or our getting enough sleep. And what can, when you talk to people, what do you tell them to adjust? Obviously, if they're drinking at night, stop doing that. But what are the other things there in their lifestyle that could help them?
Yeah, a great question. And it's one of my favorite questions, because one of the easiest things to do that, again, because of the circles that I'm in and the, you know, who I spend my time with and work with, I see this routinely, but I realize a lot of people don't know this information. I think the most important thing, and there's so much science to back it up, whether you follow like Dr. Mark Hyman, who's like a functional medicine doctor, or you're looking just on the CDC or NIH, the National Institute of Health, getting up in the morning and getting sunlight, daylight on your face in the morning, like before 10 a.m., is one of the most important things you can do for your sleep. So, and the reason for that is it helps with melatonin production. So many people are so eager to see an advertisement or read one article in some magazine or see a commercial and go out and buy a melatonin supplement that they don't even know where it came from or who made it, and pop some melatonin and hope that it's going to help them sleep. But we're born with melatonin in our body. We produce melatonin, and part of it is related to sunlight. So, depending again on you as an individual, you might need to put sunblock on to go outside and do that. Maybe you need to wear a hat, but getting some daylight, even if it's like here in Maryland today, it's cloudy, but it's still bright. Starting your day with natural light versus just in a dark room with lights, or as many people are doing nowadays, your phone or your iPad or the TV light, right? That blue light or red light. Getting the natural sunlight, for most people, generally, that would be before 10 a.m., is so important to helping you have the melatonin naturally produced by your body to help you sleep at nighttime.
That's a great tip. That's a great tip, you know, because I know, once again, take a melatonin gummy. You know, don't take it right before you go to sleep. Don't take five of them. You don't know. And, you know, just take a walk outside. That's a great, great tip. And it's an easy lifestyle thing to change.
It's free.
It's free.
And, you know, even in bad weather, depending on where you live, in most places, you could even go to a covered outside and just spend a few minutes, you know. And I usually encourage my patients, I'm like, let's take advantage of it. Let's not just go stand outside. Let's maybe take a walk around the block if you can. Or people with pets are really lucky, because if you have to walk the dog, you're generally doing that.
Like, right.
Those people are lucky in some ways because they have no choice. They have to get outside. So I'll talk about a short walk. Not only is that going to help with your melatonin production, it's getting your body moving first thing in the morning, hopefully with arthritis and different, you know, achiness, just getting things flowing. I call my morning walk my mental health walk. I don't even walk in the morning for exercise. I walk just to clear my mind and like be grateful for, find gratitude in the day, right. The ability that I could get up and walk. But many of the people that I work with can't do that. They can't go for a walk. So we talk about just getting preferably outside your door if you can, but again, that doesn't always work for people. So even right in a bright window and just three deep breaths, you know, it's again, the simple free things. I think as Americans, we're so used to everything has to be expensive and big and bold and grand. And there are simple things we can do. And I'm sure AIS talks about different breathing techniques that help you to relieve stress. So I just try to remind people to breathe. And if we're trying to just spend a few minutes of getting light, I think the science says it has to be at minimum between like 5 and 7 minutes. So you got to be out there for a few minutes, but a couple of slow deep breaths, whether you're box breathing or 4-7-8 breathing, or just breathing in and out, inhale, exhale, can be, you know, I do a couple of stretches and just, it's going to reset everything and just, you know, maybe you're mindful too while you're doing it. Maybe you're thinking about something you're grateful for. All of those things are going to help your brain to be able to sleep better at nighttime.
And you're right. They're very simple to do. And first of all, they're simple to do and they're free. That's two good things. But the other thing is you actually feel like you're doing something to help yourself. I'm doing this with a purpose. I'm breathing a certain way to help myself with my stress because it's been having a bad effect on me. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned something else. It's a lifestyle change that people have a hard time doing. And that's, you know, looking at these things, the screen and that phone and that blue light. Stop that at night. That's going to keep you up. That you know, I think it tells our brain that it's still sunny out and bright, not that it is time to go to sleep. So
again, there's so much data to support that devices, screen time, 2 to 3 hours before bed are a cause. Right. Issues with falling asleep. And you can buy all of these things. You can buy a screen protector for your phone that's blue light blocking, and reading glasses, and in your eyeglasses, they're blue light blocking. Yeah. So that is helping a tiny bit with the blue light. It's not helping with the dopamine that you're receiving from scrolling. So depending on what device you're on and what you're doing, the blue light is a piece of it, but the other piece of it is the desire to scroll and the feedback you get from that scrolling. And it's funny because I think, again, society at large might think, oh, it's just the younger people doing that, but it's not. I work, many of my patients are 65 and up. And I would say to some extent, they're even more on their iPads. It might not be their phone, it's an iPad. Whether it's playing solitaire or some other game or scrolling the news.
Yeah, I'm guilty of all of it. Yeah.
That feedback loop is feeding dopamine, which is impacting our ability to relax and sleep. I have a 17-year-old son who happens to be very much an old soul and an information seeker and philosophical. And we talk about just finding time to be bored. We don't do that anymore.
Right.
And boredom will help you sleep.
I, there's an alternative folks. It's this thing, no screens. Very interesting. It's called a book. And you can read, and it will help you relax and take you out of your world and put you in a different world. It works for me. And like I used to tell my students, it's not that you don't like to read. It's that you're not reading what you like. There is something out there for all of you that you're interested in that you can find a book on. My wife happens to be a math teacher, and she reads books about math. That'll put you to sleep. I'm just saying, you know, so you can do that. None of the blue lights. Find something to read. And I have found in my life, and again, this is all, you know, everybody is different, but that has helped me as much. Now, you talked about that you work with, did you say they were old people? Because I'm one of them.
I hope I didn't call them that.
We're old, let's face it. Yeah, this isn't chrome, it's gray. But I wanted to ask you about the specific demographic groups, and if it matters at all when it comes to suffering from sleep problems. Now, some people are in this stage of their life where they're in that rat race, they're working all the time. Students are under a lot of pressure. So everyone is different how they handle that pressure. When you get to be my age and you slow down, or you become capable enough to go, really, I don't care. So you move on from things, which does come. Does demographics, in your experience, I mean, play a significant role with sleep problems?
Ability to sleep. Yes, the phases of life and the different things that would impact our ability to sleep are different based on, again, like you're saying, if you're a student, like high school students these days, and again, I have one of them at home, right. They have so much homework, they have so much stress, their college applications, plus school starts early, there are only so many hours in the day. If they play a sport, like they may not have the ability, they might only have 7 hours to sleep. You know, whether they can fall asleep or not, they only have physically 7 hours to try to sleep. And so if they can't fall asleep, they're stuck. And then our need for sleep changes at different ages of life too. So like little babies might need 12 hours of sleep, but as you get to middle age, you in the average is like 8 hours of sleep, right? They call it 8 to 10. For many people, it's eight. But then as you get older, again, over much older, like in your 80s, right, you tend to sleep even more. And some of that is just because of energy lack. Some of it also is just not having anything to do and just being generally tired. So people might sleep more in the daytime and then have trouble sleeping at night. And then I think you mentioned in the introduction, the circadian rhythm. So there really is, again, it's not new information. I'm sure anyone listening to this podcast has heard of that before, but really that's more about just the routine. It doesn't have to be a big fancy word, but the routine of your sleep is so important. And there used to be more research that said, oh, if you like party all weekend, like you can make up your sleep. If you miss sleep, you can make up sleep. And again, Mark Hyman, the NIH, there's data that supports that, yes, for the short term, like if you travel and you change time zones, and then in the next 2 weeks, you're trying to make up your sleep, readjust your schedule, you can do that. And it does actually benefit your health and longevity that you can make up that sleep. But chronically, example, college students, if you're going to do that every week, or you're going to stay up all night for a couple nights and then try to, you know, binge sleep for a couple of days, that does not improve your health. That does not help you. You are not making it up. Short term, rarely, once in a while, yes, you can, and it does benefit your whole body, but chronic, it does not, it hurts you. It doesn't help you. And that's really important. So the idea of a sleep routine, it's funny. I'm a reader. My son and I love to read all different things. And the only thing I would say about reading a book is you can't read something too exciting at bedtime. Because I know I have friends too that, you know, if they're reading some trashy romance novel, they don't want to put it down. So you have to find the balance of something too invigorating to even to read at bedtime, you know, but read something that is interesting, but you're able to put it down or set a timer to stop yourself to go to sleep. But having a routine bedtime within an hour each way, even on the days off and on the weekend, that it's within a routine so that it's natural, so that you don't rely on the alarm waking you up, that your body is generally ready to wake up around the time that the alarm would go off, or that you're feeling generally tired around the time that you routinely go to sleep, is so much better for your body and is going to help you in the long run once you establish that habit.
And people really shouldn't change that on weekends.
Generally not. Right.
Because it throws you off.
Yes.
I was an educator. I taught high school for a long time. And, you know, you get up at 5 every morning. Well, if on the weekend, I stayed out until 1 in the morning, I still woke up at 5. My body alarm clock still woke up at 5. So I ended up being sleep deprived over the weekend when I had a chance to rest. So, yeah, those things. Now, we're talking about the demographics. So is there any – now, some of it's unavoidable. You have a baby, forget about it. You just promise sleep is a goal more than an option. And but do you think there's a difference between how men and women sleep?
That's a good question. I can't think off the top of my head about the science behind the differences. I will say though, just from my knowledge of homeostasis and hormone release and hormone data, that women definitely release more oxytocin generally, and oxytocin definitely helps with sleep. It's one of the reasons that breastfed babies tend to sleep so well, because they get oxytocin through the breast milk, and like cuddling releases hormones like oxytocin and helps us sleep. But I don't off the top of my head know like science behind the difference between men and women sleeping.
I would think that women probably sleep worse than men, because if you're married, your husband's snoring and keeping you up all night.
Well, physical
I'm just saying.
Factors, that's fair. And physical factors in your space are really important. So most of the research supports that it needs to be on the cooler side. Most people sleep
I was gonna
better
ask you about that.
If the space is cold.
Right.
Most people sleep better with quiet, right? Not screaming or a constant sound,
like a fan
in your room, or a noise machine, or some dull vibrational noise. Dark, again, lights off. If you have any opportunity to be not in bright lights, to lower the lights, to dim the lights, to turn some lights off in your space a couple hours before bedtime, that's helpful. And then for your room to be dark. Again, it depends. And I have to think about this when working with people, because if you need to know where the bathroom is, because you're going to get up and go to the bathroom multiple times, it's important, particularly if we're taking any type of substance, we want people to be able to safely get to the bathroom in the middle of the night. And at the same time, it needs to be the lowest possible light, or maybe a light that comes on with a sensor just when you walk past it, so that the room can be dark.
Right.
Or if you're wearing an eye mask.
Or a certain spectrum.
Right? Or a certain spectrum, or earplugs. Like all of these things, setting yourself up for that environment. Another thing is what you do physically right before bed, right? So again, I talked about some people trying to squeeze in the workout right before bedtime. The research really does say for most people, that's not a good idea. That it's too stimulating to do a physical, like aerobic workout or a weightlifting workout, right at nighttime, at bedtime. It should be a couple hours before bedtime. But doing some stretching or some yoga, depending on your level of ability, it could just be chair yoga, a little bit of stretching. It's different release of hormones. It's good for your body and can help to promote
That's
better.
what I do. I stretch a little before I go to sleep because everything hurts. We touched on something, and I'd like to have a little bit of a conversation about it. And that is the taking of medication to go to sleep. I have to tell you that I understand why certain people need it. I have two friends whose wives both have jobs that start at night. They just switched to night shift, so it's very hard for them to sleep during the day. So that's a factor also. But I'm not a big you're a nurse. I'm don't really know. I just ask questions. But of what I've heard, the medications that are given for sleep, every once in a while, no big deal. But if you get to start using it every night to sleep, that's a problem, isn't it? I mean, some of those medications, I mean, God, some of the stories I've heard about sleepwalking and things like that, they're scary. People have gotten into cars not knowing it. I mean,
Yeah.
talk a little bit about that, and, how that affects us.
Part of the reason that I'm in the field that I am doing what I do is because I really like to find food related or herb related or plant related, cannabis related options other than some prescriptions. I am an integrative medicine nurse, not an alternative medicine nurse. I do believe in prescriptions and that there is a time and a place for them. And sometimes for the short term, we need to take a prescription for an ailment. And it might be a sleeping medication for a diagnosed insomnia by a doctor, hopefully for the short term because of some type of crisis or whatever it is. However, what most of us would know of as sleeping pills that are prescribed, are extremely addictive. Like addictive, like if you would think to yourself, I don't want to take opioids, I don't want to take narcotics, you probably would be concerned also about taking these benzodiazepines, which are these sleeping pills. They're innocent people accidentally become dependent on them. And then they also have side effects depending on what time you take them, when you take them. Many of my patients report that they feel hungover in the morning, groggy in the morning. They slept, but they don't feel rested. And again, if it's no sleep at all for days, weeks, months on end, we might need that. We might any sleep is better than no sleep in some senses. But there are so many options that can have less side effects. And if you are really willing to be accountable and put in the effort to try all these other lifestyle changes, these things you can do that essentially do not cost money, are free, are accessible. There's no socioeconomic barrier to getting some daylight in the morning. I mean, again, it might be that you're in an apartment and you can't just walk out your front door and you might need to go to a window, that there's some or your neighborhood is safe enough to walk outside. There definitely are some barriers, but many of the things we have the ability to control and to do for ourselves to help with sleep that are not taking prescriptions. And I am lucky enough to be working in a state and remotely in some other states where we do have options for medical cannabis. Some of the states have adult use cannabis where anybody can go to a store and buy something. And there is science behind THC, particularly helping people sleep. Part of the reason is it has data to support that it is stress relieving and reduces anxiety. Maybe it's because it stops the repetitive thoughts, particularly for someone with post-traumatic stress disorder or someone that's just an overthinker. That type of anxiety, it blocks that signal to your brain to stop those thoughts, which allows a sense of peace and ability to sleep. For many people, It's about the pain. It's about it blocking the pain receptor to your brain so that you're not hurting as much, so that you can sleep, or so that you don't wake up in the middle of the night in pain. However, it's not for everyone either. And we have to consider all the factors and how impaired can you be, and are you at risk for falling? And there's just so many factors. So it's not at all one size fits all. And again, there are over-the-counter pain things that you can take. And even we mentioned melatonin right. In the right amount, which who knows what the right amount for you is. Usually it's less than most people take.
Like, right.
Our culture says more is better. And in many fields, and particularly in cannabis, it's actually a U-shaped curve. I was just speaking at a conference in Rhode Island last week, and my friend Dustin Sulak was presenting, and he showed the U-shaped curve, which is where you find a dose, it starts to work, you get excited, then you keep increasing that dose, and you get to a point where you get less benefit because you're really taking too much of the plant medicine rather than just that low dose right amount.
Well, let me ask you, if when you recommend a patient who's suffering from insomnia try cannabis for sleeping with THC, does it help with both problems? Usually the two problems with insomnia are either falling asleep or staying asleep. So does cannabis work for both of those things?
The interesting thing about cannabis, which it's this way about prescriptions too, we just don't have as many options. So especially when you're buying legal medical cannabis in a dispensary, you have options for the route of administration. So most people think, oh, THC, they think smoke it, get high. So one option when you shop at a dispensary, even a medical dispensary as a patient, is to inhale the cannabis, whether that's smoking the flower in a joint or a pipe or something, or whether that's using a vapor pen, a concentrated vape. And in the dispensary, we also have the option to use a tincture, which traditionally is alcohol, but in Maryland in particular, they're mostly oil-based tinctures where you put this oil under your tongue. There's also tablets and gummies and lozenges and chewies and topicals. There are all these routes of administration, and the route of administration is what impacts how long it's going to last. Usually when I work with someone, we talk about, do you have trouble falling asleep or staying asleep? And then we adjust a like toolbox of this medicine. And again, it's not a prescription. It's me providing information, kind of like I'm doing today, and then saying, check with your doctor, and you choose what you want to do. But that inhalation route, which even if we had like a sleeping pill that was a prescription that was inhalation, it would be the same idea, because when you inhale, generally with cannabis, the onset comes on quickly, like 15 to 30 seconds, and then the effect lasts for 1 to 2 hours. So if your problem is falling asleep, anxiety at bedtime, stress, repetitive thoughts just at bedtime, then inhalation might be really helpful for you to fall asleep. And then maybe you don't need anything else, and that's a very low dose, and it doesn't last for very long, and then you sleep through the rest of the night. But if your problem is staying asleep, then you could potentially, like you mentioned with a glass of wine, fall asleep, but then not stay asleep. And then what? So a different route of administration, something in that edible form. We even have, again, it's all state by state. Again, cannabis is Schedule I. It's federally illegal. Each state makes their own rules and regulations. So the products available in each state are different. Mm-hmm. I'll speak to Maryland, even though I know many of the states. Maryland has some time-released capsules. So similar to taking a prescription or taking something right. You'd buy at the grocery store, it lasts for 8 to 10 hours. Most edibles, like if we take a cannabis gummy, last for 5 to 6 hours. So again, helpful, but maybe not ideal if you want to sleep longer than that, right? So
well, I think once you're sleeping for 5 hours, you're probably going to stay asleep. The chances are, I think,
You'd be surprised. So I have some people that, like the most extreme example would be someone who inhales a little bit of cannabis. I mean, very little, like 1 to 2 puffs of inhalation of cannabis when they're trying to get ready to go to sleep. And then right before, like they're ready, like I can feel it, I'm getting ready to fall asleep, they pop some type of a sublingual tablet or a gummy or something in their mouth. The problem with edibles is they take 1 to 2 hours for most people to have an effect.
Right.
So
it has to be digested.
That we're covering with the inhalation, we're covering the first couple hours, then the gummy is covering the majority of the night. And then sometimes, depending on the person, they might, if they wake up and it's 5 a.m. and they were really hoping to sleep till 7, they might take one more puff of something. Or if they wake up because they're in pain because the cannabis wore off and now they have a leg cramp or back pain, they might be able to use a topical, just rub it on real quick. It's right by the bedside. And then that helps just enough to give them that couple more hours of rest. It really is, it's like, it's all the one plant and different pieces of a plant being pulled out into these different routes of administration. But then we layer them and use them to fit that particular person. And again, there is, we need more research. We need more research on right. humans in the United States, but there's a lot of research in other countries. We have a lot of data to support. And then even myself, I have a lot of anecdotal data from working with thousands of patients over the years.
And I've read, a lot of the research because it's stress related. I will tell you this of what I've seen. And you can correct me if I'm wrong. When I see a commercial for Ambien, the bottom with this small print of possible side effects are terrifying. It's a Stephen King movie. It's like, everything from diarrhea to death. Okay, well, those are not good things. So, have you seen or has the research shown that many side effects from the use of cannabis or THC or even CBD?
Yeah, it's a great question. And yes, one of the things I often start with when I'm talking to patients is that their medication list, what they're taking. And then my goal is, I don't want to harm you, right? I want to help. So tell me what side effects, what things are bugging you the most? And so often their things they're dealing with are side effects from the multiple prescriptions. And I am a fan of physicians and medical practices. Again, integrative medicine, bringing East and West together, looking at the whole person. Our current healthcare system has us in very disparate lanes. And so you might see a neurologist and an endocrinologist and a primary, maybe you see your primary less because you're in all these, your GI doctor, and everybody's prescribing things. And hopefully they're looking. I'm sure that at least the computer system, I used to work for Johns Hopkins on the electronic health record. At least the computer system is drug interaction checking to make sure it's safe enough.
These days.
But one prescription might be causing a side effect that another prescription is making worse. The biggest one, right, is constipation.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting how if we look at and we just talk about, again, because I have more time, because I'm more like I call it a health mentor. Like I'm here to not coach you and talk to you every single step of the way, but to give you tools to take care of it yourself. And we just look at, well, if you took this medication 2 hours before this one, or do you realize when you take these together, they're competing? Or if you took this one before your food, and like, it's confusing. And and even I'm a huge fan of pharmacists. I work closely with a lot of pharmacists. Even pharmacists only have so much time, and you as the consumer might feel like, I don't want to take that consult time at CVS or whatever pharmacy you're shopping at. And so it's really good to have someone, maybe even just a caregiver, family member, look at the whole picture and all the side effects and try to figure out where everything fits. Some people even just do this as a business, medication reconciliation, just looking at all the meds and figuring out when really is the best time, and should we be taking them all together, and what are we taking them for? And is one, like, am I now taking all of these vitamin supplements that I saw on Google to give me energy because I'm taking this pill at nighttime that's making me sleepy in the morning? It's so complicated, and cannabis fits in all of that. So thankfully, THC does not have a lot of drug interactions. It does not have a lot of risks. The receptors in our body that allow THC to block signals to your brain or help with nerve pain, which is a big one, because so many medications don't help with nerve pain and PTSD and you know, psilocybin's a whole nother topic, but we have lots of good research coming about psilocybin and PTSD. But cannabis doesn't have receptors in the brainstem where respirations are, which is why, unlike a medication like morphine, which we would give in the hospital that could stop you from breathing, cannabis doesn't do that by itself. However, and again, this is a big part of the education, cannabis with narcotics, cannabis with your sleeping pill, cannabis with your glass of wine acts differently. Mm. And generally all of those things, the impact is bigger and stronger together, which we can use to our advantage if we use low doses, but also could be harmful. And well, so,
you important. Know, that's why we have nurses like you. I've always said, like, if I broke my toe and I went to a neurologist, it would be a neuro problem. Really? Dude. I broke my toe, but whenever I've spoken to nurses, because I absolutely love nurses, I'd rather deal with a nurse than a doctor almost any day. They have a much more global view of you. And I have to say, I'm really grateful. We're running a little long on time. I'm really grateful the amount of information that you're giving us. The options. So if you're out there and you're suffering from insomnia and sleep and the stress of it all, you have options. You've heard a bunch of them. Go to nurselaura.com and ask her. And depending on what state you're in, you even have some, you know, some options you may not have considered before. Sleep is such a big topic. It's like one of the top three that come up all the time at AIS. And it's why I wanted to have you here and speak about it. I've known people that have used all kinds of things to help them sleep. Pharmaceutical drugs, cannabis, gummies, whatever, melatonin. Just when it's a problem, it's your whole life. That takes up your whole life. Mm-hmm. So. Laura, I want to thank you for coming here. I got one last question I ask all my guests. And what is your personal go-to for stress relief? What do you do? What does Nurse Laura do when she's feeling stressed out?
Dancing. So, yes. Awesome. I really believe in the power of getting physical, sweating a little. And exercise, again, to help release those brain chemicals. And I'm not a runner, but you know how, like, runners talked about the endorphin release, right? That runner's high. I joke all the time, because I am a cannabis nurse, but I'm not a big cannabis user, and I'm not a big pharmaceutical drug user, and I don't really drink alcohol, but dancing is my drug of choice. And so almost anytime, anywhere, especially with the invention of a phone that you can have music on. I don't even really need music, but moving, dancing, just kind of shaking out the stress is my number one way to relieve stress.
That is awesome. That's great. That's a great answer. And you know what they say, dance like nobody's watching.
Yes.
Laura, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you for all the information you have given us. Again, go to AskNurseLaura.com and find out some more stuff. And I want to, you know, I appreciate the fact that you gave us the straight answers about everything. Not one thing is right for everyone. So that's going to do it for today. This has been your host, Will Heckman. I want to thank you all for joining us today. And please don't forget to follow this podcast, hit the like button, hit the subscribe button. And again, I want to remind everyone, just as stress is different for each of us, there's no one stress reduction or management strategy that's right for everyone. So that means you need to join us next time and find out what we explore in stress management and strategies, insights. And I hope what Laura and I have had to said have it's easy for me to say, I've said today is hope you find your way to contentment. Good day, everyone.